This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is comic, actor, and writer Michael Ian Black. He's written a new memoir called Navel Gazing, True Tales of Bodies, Mostly Mine, but Also My Mom's, which I know sounds weird. He describes the book as focusing on time, the family, and the body, subjects he started thinking about seriously after his mother got sick and after he turned 40. But even when he's serious, he manages to be funny. Now in his mid-40s, he's co-starring in the Jim Gaffigan Show on the TV Land Network and another period on Comedy Central. He was in the film Wet Hot American Summer, as well as the recent Netflix prequel. In the 90s, he was one of the stars of the MTV sketch comedy series The State. And in 2009, he co-starred with Michael Showalter in the Comedy Central series Michael and Michael Have Issues. He spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Michael Ian Black, welcome back to Fresh Air. So some of this book is about your body and how your body and life have been changing in middle age. And you say that the person you see in your head when you think, me, doesn't look much like the person you see when you look in the mirror. Would you compare the two?
Well, I was being a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I wrote the book and talked about the description of myself that I imagine myself to be, but not that much tongue-in-cheek. It's a weird thing as an actor, I find, and maybe other actors don't have this problem, but I have a very hard time looking at myself on screen because in my head, when I'm acting, I always imagine myself as looking totally different than the person that appears on screen. And then when I see the person appearing on screen, I'm inevitably disappointed. I'm always like, oh no, not that guy. That's not the guy at all that I had pictured. But sort of my avatar for myself, I jokingly call Bruce Whitehall, and he is a rangy, lantern-jawed, six-foot-tall Aryan god. He's a Hitler youth, essentially.
So bodies are the thing, I think, that make us most self-conscious. And they do weird things when we don't want them to. What has your attitude been about how much to reveal about your relationship with your body and all the things that make you self-conscious about your body, knowing that you are physically going to be represented on screen, knowing that you're going to be standing up alone on stage in front of audiences who have nothing to do with their eyes except stare at you?
That didn't play into my thought process. If it had, maybe I wouldn't have written the book. I don't have that kind of foresight.
You should have spoken to me. I could have saved you the effort of writing a book.
Well, then I would have had nothing to write about. I felt like it was important to write about male vanity because, one, it's something that consumes me a little bit, but also because I don't feel like there's a lot of societal permission to talk about male vanity in the same way that there is to talk about female vanity. There's an entire industry. I mean, the whole female culture is built on female vanity. And I feel like men don't have the same kind of permission to talk about their own bodies in the same way. I think it's destructive for women in a lot of ways. But I also think it's destructive for men to not have a kind of outlet to talk about their own insecurities. And so I wanted to sort of lay bare my own in an effort to sort of open that conversation.
Yeah, you know, reading your book, I was wondering, I have some sense of what women look for when we look at ourselves in the mirror. I have no idea what men look for.
When we look at ourselves or when we look at women?
No.
Because I can tell you what we look for in women, which is just that they be women.
When you look
at
yourself.
That's really all we care about. When I look at myself, I don't even know that I'm looking for any one particular thing so much as I'm looking for a kind of aesthetic joy that I cannot find. All I see, and I think women are probably the same, all I see are the imperfections. I see that my nose runs off to the side of my face, and I see that one eyebrow cocks upwards no matter what I do to try to correct it. I inevitably will wake up and there will be some blemish on my face that wasn't there the day before. My stomach, which continues to expand. My arms, which continue to be noodly and flaccid. Like, it's everything, you know? And so it's just a constant cataloging of all the things that are wrong. And it's not even like I feel like addressing any one of those things would solve the problem. I feel like it would just start other problems. It's very it's unsettling. I don't know how to make myself feel good about myself physically, other than to just kind of resign myself to I am who I am.
Can you effectively do that, the I am who I am thing?
Some days I can. Most days I cannot.
So it bothers you?
Yeah. I mean, it's not something that is ever present in my mind, but it is something that, you know, it's a little tickle at the back of my brain that I can't ever quite scratch.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic Michael Ian Black, who's also an actor, and he's a co-star of the Jim Gaffigan Show. He has a new book called Navel Gazing, True Tales of Bodies, Mostly Mine, But Also My Mom's, which I know sounds weird. Okay, so when you hear that title, that it's a true tale of bodies, mostly mine, but also my mom's, which I know sounds weird, it has a kind of creepily sexual connotation about your mother there. But it's not about that at all. It's when you refer
well,
to
I
your,
would hope not, no.
Yes, when you refer to your mother's body in there, it's because it's about how her body has been physically diminished by surgeries and treatments for uterine cancer.
Yes.
And since you bring up the subject of your mother's body in the title, like before you even open the pages of the book, you see your mother's body. It leads me to wonder if her surgeries and her cancer have kind of forced you to think about or help out with your mother's body in ways that have really changed your relationship with her.
Well, yes, in the sense that her illness has forced me to obviously confront her mortality and to confront her ever-weakening state. No, in the sense that I'm not physically there. We live thousands of miles apart, so I'm not giving her sponge baths. But yeah, I mean, I certainly know much more about her body, both because of her illnesses and because of the interviews I conducted when writing this book. That's a weird thing. It's a weird thing to talk about your mother's body, which is why I wrote, which I know it sounds weird, in the subtitle.
Well, it's interesting that you interviewed her for the book, because in the book you ask her if she's afraid of death, and she says, "Afraid? I'm petrified." Mm-hmm. So did you ask her that in the context of interviewing her for the book?
Yeah, yeah. All of the dialogue that's in the book is verbatim from interviews that I did with her for the book. And yeah, that moment was really kind of startling for me, because she's been dealing with this for like 15 years, these illnesses and her body slowly failing her. And I guess I sort of thought at a certain point in dealing with constant illness and bodily deterioration that you make some accommodations with death, and she hasn't. And when I asked her why she felt so terrified of dying, she said, "Because I feel like I haven't done anything with my life." And that was such a kind of heartbreaking and startling and upsetting thing to hear from one's parent.
It's interesting to me that you asked your mother if she was afraid of dying in the context of interviewing her for the book. You know, I ask people all the time in the context of interviews how they feel about facing death. When my parents were dying, it was hard to talk with them about it because I think they were uncomfortable talking about it. Were you able to ask your mother things in the context of, "Mom, I have to interview you for my book," that you maybe would have been uncomfortable asking her without that pretext?
Oh, everything. Everything was uncomfortable. I mean, I asked her all about her sex life, which is not something I recommend a son ask his mother. I mean, it's very awkward, particularly because my mother's sexual life is complicated. I mean, she came out as a lesbian when I was about 5, and that broke up my parents' marriage. Not that it was on very firm footing to begin with. And then she entered a very long kind of abusive relationship, which is the relationship that I grew up within with a woman I call Elaine in the book. And we talked a lot about the traumas of her sexuality, and a lot of it was traumatic. Her parents forced her to undergo shock therapy when she was in her late teens.
To make her ungay.
To ungay her, yeah. They thought she was gay, and she didn't believe herself to be gay at that point. But they did. And in fact, it kind of wiped her memory clean of a lot of her early life. So, I mean, the toughest questions were probably just the first ones, you know, just tell me about, you know, being gay, you know, just the first question. And then once we got into it, it became easier and easier to talk to her about it. And I think she was very happy to have those conversations because, you know, I'm a parent and I know that my kids, they express no interest in me whatsoever in terms of what my life was like before they came along. And I think that's probably a familiar feeling for parents. Like last night, I was trying to tell my daughter something. She's 12. And I was going to tell her about something when I was her age. And I started to say the words when I was 12. And she said, I don't want to hear it. I was like, okay, that's fair.
How old were you when your mother came out?
5.
What year are we talking?
1976, maybe. 77.
How did she explain it to you, that her new partner was going to be a woman?
She didn't. Not that I recall. I mean, they had been together before this, but my earliest memory of seeing them together in a way that I understood as couplehood was after they had moved in together, which they did very shortly after my parents broke up. And I walked into their bedroom one morning and they were in bed together, you know, just laying there, you know, whatever. And in that moment, I feel like I understood something about their relationship that I hadn't before. I didn't put any judgment on it. I didn't think of it in negative terms at all. I think I was too young to understand that the larger culture wouldn't approve of this. But I felt like I understood it in that moment.
And then, and I forget how old you were at the time, but at one point when you were a child, your mother talks to you and tries to reassure you that it's okay for you to be gay because right. She thought that you were gay, which you're not. That just sounds like the most odd conversation, that your lesbian mother is assuring you that it's okay for you to be gay when you're not gay.
She was trying to out me.
Yes. Just describe that conversation.
Well, she and her partner invited me to sit in the living room, which should have set off alarm bells because nobody was allowed to sit in our living room because that was reserved for company.
Oh, yes.
Despite the fact that we never had company. Nobody ever came over, but that was for company. And so they invited me to sit in the living room, on the floor, incidentally, not on the furniture. And they started by saying that, you know, it's totally natural and fine to be gay. And my first thought was, had I said something that made them think that I disapproved of their relationship, which I did, but not because of their homosexuality, but because it was just a disastrous relationship. And then over the course of the conversation, it occurred to me that they were talking about me. I was probably 13, 14, something like that. And I was, you know, mortified and infuriated. And it was so presumptuous of them and so sort of crossing so many boundaries. I didn't even know how to respond. I mean, I was just sputtering with rage when they said this to me. And in retrospect, I get it. I mean, I do understand why they thought I may have been gay, and the answers are because I was interested in theater and because my friends were mostly female and because, I don't know, I maybe expressed myself a certain way or spoke in a certain way. And maybe had I been an adult looking at me, I would have thought, oh, that's the gay kid. But they could have asked, you know what I mean? They could have said, are you having these feelings? But I wasn't at all. I mean, being straight was the only thing I knew about myself to be true. I mean, I knew that I was straight. I adored girls. And the reason that I had so many friends who were girls was because I adored girls and preferred their company to the company of my peers who were all, I had skipped a grade and they were all a year to 2 years older than me. And sort of were more advanced in terms of their just physical development. And it was intimidating to be around a lot of the guys in my school. And so I just surrounded myself with these girls and loved them.
You write about your mother and her partner. While they struggled for women and girls to be free to become whoever they chose, it never occurred to them that some men and boys felt just as stifled, boys like me. Nobody ever told me that there were different ways to be male, so I felt forced to improvise, play with masculine conventions, and find ways to bend them to meet my own needs. They misinterpreted that improvisation as sexual confusion. So what are some of the ways of being male that just didn't fit for you?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey in, you know, my formative years were kind of the mid-80s, and the mid-80s in New Jersey became kind of like ground zero for American culture in general. It was sort of like where Bon Jovi came from and sort of the big hair sound and the kind of like dumb metal culture that pervaded America in that time. And there was a huge emphasis on sports in the town where I grew up in. And there was just a kind of sort of masculine swagger that guys had. And they were expected to sort of, I don't know, have letter jackets and be interested in cars and be interested in talking about football teams. And none of that meant anything to me. It's a familiar story. I mean, I think a lot of boys grow up feeling that way. But I didn't have a dad in my life. My dad died when I was 12, and my parents were estranged anyway, so I didn't see him that much. And I just didn't know that I didn't have to conform to that. I sort of intuited it. And the way I rebelled was to do things that were sort of anti-masculine. I would cross my legs the way a girl crossed her legs, or I would dress in a way that didn't conform to the way the guys in my school dressed. And I surrounded myself with female friends. And all of that was an attempt to assert myself as an individual and as a kind of young man. But I didn't fully understand that at the time about myself. Like, it all felt improvisational. It all felt like a kind of formless rebellion.
Did the things that made your mother think that you were gay make other people think that you were gay?
Oh, yeah. Everybody thought I was gay. I mean, you know, New Jersey culture, and I think it's probably still this way, is very regimented for guys. You know, it's where Bruce Springsteen comes from. You know, it's got a very peculiar flavor of masculinity, and it's hard to not be a part of that. Maybe it's different growing up there now than it was. I mean, maybe we've kind of expanded, you know, what it means to be a man. But when I was growing up there, at least, it really felt very confining, and I couldn't wait to get out.
So you co-star in Jim Gaffigan's comedy series, which is loosely based on Gaffigan's family, about
where
him.
Where I play a gay guy?
Yeah,
his
wife.
Yes, I play a gay guy on
and many
the show,
children,
yes.
And you're the wife's best friend who is gay. And you basically live in their house. You're always there, and you don't get along with Jim Gaffigan in the series, so you're always kind of like getting in these little digs at him. It's kind of funny that people assumed you were gay, now like you're playing somebody who is gay.
I'm almost always hired to play gay. Like, it, you know, like it's never left. Like, that whole thing. I mean, you know, my first movie role is in Wet Hot American Summer, where I play a gay counselor, and I've played gay in so many things. And, you know, it's like with anything else, you know, you just kind of make peace with it at a certain point. You're like, all right, you know, I can do that for you. I can do other things, and hopefully people will see me and let me do other things. And they have, thankfully, particularly in recent years. But yeah, I always get hired to play gay.
So let's get back to middle age. And you're in your 40s now.
Mm-hmm.
That's an age where you have a lot of responsibilities. You are one of those people in that position where you have a mother who's sick. You don't live geographically close, but you have emotional and I'm sure some more, you know, physical responsibilities for her. You're the father of two. Your sister has Down syndrome. She lives in a facility. You end your book by explaining that your wife has had a few recurring bouts of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. So you just have responsibility on all ends right now, including, you know, making sure some of your TV shows actually stay on the air. So you have more income coming in. Do you feel, you know, kind of like weighed down by all of this? Or
yeah, I do. But I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, as much as the responsibilities sort of pile on top of each other as I've gotten older, I also find myself increasingly happier. And I don't know if that's just the kind of natural aging process or if that's a result of the antidepressants I'm on or what it is. But I'm happier than I've ever been and feel a sense of gratitude almost all the time when I stop to think about it, which is often, actually. I do have a lot of responsibilities, but I'm okay with it. And I guess I like it. I mean, I guess I like having that on my shoulders. A lot of what I write about is, as we talked about earlier, masculinity, and not just the way a man, I think, presents himself to the world. But what I'm learning about masculinity as I get older is a lot of the kind of male archetypes ring true to me. The idea of the man shouldering a burden and doing it willfully, I feel like it gives me purpose and it gives me optimism in a way, and it inspires me both because I want to do right by the people who depend on me and also because I'm terrified that I won't. And so I'm inspired to do things professionally that maybe I wouldn't otherwise, you know, if I didn't have these burdens. And that's been great for me. It's been great to have the responsibility of other people because it forces me to engage with the world in a way that I might not.
So, you know, when you're in show business, age is a demographic issue too. Like, yeah. You know, some people might think at a certain age you outgrow the demographic that they're looking for, and therefore, right. Like, you don't matter anymore. Have you?
Well, that's when you sort of move into the NPR world. You see, I started on MTV, and then I was popular on VH1 briefly, and now I'm moving into NPR. It's all very calculated.
I can see that. Michael Ian Black, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry, so much.
Michael Ian Black speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. He co-stars on The Jim Gaffigan Show on the TV Land Network and on the Comedy Central series Another Period.
Is there one trouble so these hands of mine could hold? Who's gonna miss me when I'm gone?
At the age of 83, Loretta Lynn is still making vibrant music. She's just released her first new album in 4 years. She was also the recent subject of a PBS American Masters titled Still a Mountain Girl. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of her new album called Full Circle.
In the pines where the sun never shines, and a shiver when the cold winds blow. My love, what have I done to make you treat me so?
Loretta Lynn's new album, Full Circle, mixes new original material with Lynn's interpretations of country music classics, such as the song that began this review, In the Pines. This album includes a re-recording of the first song she ever wrote, Whispering Sea, written when she was 25. And its lyric about a, quote, old love affair that used to be, has a timeless ring.
Sat down by the sea, and it whispered to me. It brought back an old love affair that used to be. It told me that you had found someone new and left me to cry over you. Whispering sea. The drifting whispering sea.
She writes in her liner notes, I will always be a songwriter-singer, which inverts the usual phrase singer-songwriter to place the emphasis where Lynn wants it, on her work as an artist who crafts imagery and stories. There's an elegiac quality to some of Full Circle, the sense that Lynn is acknowledging she is inevitably coming to the end of her career in a song such as Who's Gonna Miss Me? Yet any sorrow in that sentiment is prevented from descending into self-pity by her crisp, firm singing, a firmness she applies to even greater effect on another original song here, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven.
Everybody Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Once upon a time there lived a man, and his name was Hezekiah. He walked with God both day and night, but he didn't want to die. He cried, oh Lord, please let me live. Death is close, I know. God smiled down on Hezekiah and gave him 15 years to go. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Lord, I want to go to heaven, but I don't want to die. Still, I love living here on earth. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Full Circle is co-produced by John Carter Cash and her daughter Patsy Lynn Russell, and they surround Lynn with beautifully understated but precise arrangements, with mandolin, pedal steel guitar, and upright bass prominent in the mix. This is less a throwback to an earlier era of country record making than it is about creating an open atmosphere for Lynn's vocals to fill.
I love you more than she ever will. But the only way she can get a man is still. I don't know if I should tell you this or not. She's got everything it takes to take everything you've got. And when she takes.
To be sure, there's been some deterioration in her voice in her eighth decade, but like any first-rate singer of popular music, she uses her weaknesses as strengths, letting you hear a vulnerability and informality that is somewhat new to her music. Listen to what she does with an atypically loose, almost jazzy version of Band of Gold, not the 1970 Freda Payne soul music hit, but the 1955 pop ballad.
I never wanted wealth untold. My life has one desire. A simple little band of gold to prove that you are mine. Don't want the world to have and hold, for fame is not my line. Just want a little band of gold to prove that you are mine. Some sell away.
It was recently reported that Lynn has been working steadily on her legacy. Since 2007, she's been working with her daughter Patsy, John Carter Cash, and songwriters such as Todd Snyder on the recording of many songs she's written in notebooks over the years. Loretta Lynn has apparently already recorded entire albums of songs, both her own and covers of everything from gospel to Christmas music. It's all material she wants to record as a completion of her lifelong project, of creating a vivid portrait of a coal miner's daughter grown into one of the greatest performers country music has ever known.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Loretta Lynn's new album, Full Circle. Coming up, actress Regina King, who stars in the ABC series American Crime and co-stars in the HBO series The Leftovers. Two TV series, ABC's American Crime and HBO's The Leftovers, showcase the talent of our next guest, actress Regina King, by giving her the opportunity to play three different complex characters. She's been acting professionally since she was a teenager, when she played the daughter in the 1980s sitcom 227. Then she co-starred in the 1991 film Boys in the Hood. In Jerry Maguire, she played Cuba Gooding's assertive, protective wife. In the Ray Charles biopic, she played Margie Hendrix, one of his backup singers and lovers. She starred in the series Southland as an LAPD detective, and she's recently started directing, including a couple of episodes of Scandal. King spoke with Terry last Monday. They began with American Crime, which just ended its second season. It's an anthology series which in the first two seasons featured the same leading actors but in different stories and different roles. In season one, Regina King played a convert to Islam whose brother is addicted to drugs and is accused of murder. In season two, King played a successful corporate executive who lives in an affluent community. Her son's the captain of the basketball team at a private school, but when he's implicated in the bullying and possible rape of a high school boy, the lives of all the families affected start to unravel as the parents defend their children. In the process, a hacker leaks private emails, including those of Regina King's character. After her emails become public, she's called into her boss's office.
This isn't a comfortable conversation. We've known each other a long time.
I want you to know what's happening now. It's a business decision. Your family's gone through a lot, but there are things that have come out online.
Okay, let me stop you. My son has been exonerated in connection with this assault.
Terry.
Hold on. Kevin has been cleared. And as far as we know, those medical records, they came from the Leland School. So anything anybody's saying about Michael...
This isn't about your son or your husband. There are any number of emails out there where you say some pretty... They're ugly things about people. Particularly whites.
My family has been through an ordeal and you want to talk to me about personal emails? Okay. For people of color, there's a world that we live in that's different than yours. One you'll never, ever experience.
Terry.
And the way we express those experiences out of context can be taken to mean something that they don't.
I wouldn't want anyone going through my emails. But you talk about white trash. You talk about white entitlement.
That's nothing compared to what my family and families like ours deal with daily. Money or not, status or not, we deal. And it may not sound correct, but I have a right to my privacy.
You do, but this is a publicly held company.
We told the truth. You're gonna punish us for that?
Regina King, welcome to Fresh Air. As we heard in that scene, American crime has really tried to take on issues that are difficult to talk about, like race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and the kinds of disagreements, misunderstanding, and violence that erupts. And I'm wondering if you've had to, in character, say things that ever made you uncomfortable saying, or that people responded to in ways that really surprised you because they didn't quite get the point that you or the script was trying to make.
No, but I will say that there are things that Terry and her family discuss that are things that are discussed in real life in my family and in families across the country who aren't white. And race is a very sensitive subject. And what happens a lot of times when, let's just speak specifically white and black, when white or black people feel misunderstood when it comes to talking about race, they immediately get defensive. And just because someone doesn't understand doesn't mean they don't want to. It's an honest place to be if you don't understand someone else's experience. But there's no way for the other to understand if a conversation or an explanation isn't made.
You got an Emmy for season one of American Crime. I'm interested in your reactions to the protests that surrounded the absence of African-American Oscar nominees this year. Where is the problem, do you think, in terms of there not being more movies with African-American characters, African-American directors and writers? Do you think films like that don't get green-lighted because of preconceptions that there won't be a big enough audience or it won't do well internationally? There's a lot of talent out there. How come there aren't more films, do you think?
Well, I think it's a combination of not being enough films that are telling stories that deal with other cultures and other races. And there's also not enough films that are more of an imitation of what real life looks like. Like, for example, when you look at American Crime and you have the character of Terry LaCroix is a pharmaceutical executive. Why does that character always have to be white? So it's looking at things like that as well. The good news for me is that I have an amazing team behind me, and they've been with me for almost 20 years. And they have seen me as an actress, not necessarily just a Black actress. So I have been lucky enough for them to see me that way, and they have pursued things that were written white, and I ended up getting them. Southland was not written for a Black woman. Legally Blonde 2 wasn't written specifically for a Black woman. Year of the Dog was not written for a Black woman, but they read those scripts and they approached those writers and those producers, and cut to, I was doing those films.
So you got your start. How old were you when you got cast in 227?
I think we shot the pilot of 227 when I was 13.
227 was a family sitcom. You're the daughter, and you're the teenage daughter. And so it's about the family and the other people who live in the building. Were you kind of mentored by the adults on there? And specifically, like Marla Gibbs, she had been on The Jeffersons. Had you watched that? Were you kind of in awe of her because of that?
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. I mean, The Jeffersons, that was like the greatest TV, you know, for... me growing up, I loved The Jeffersons. I thought that Florence was so hilarious. I loved the banter between her and George Jefferson. But the reality was that if The Jeffersons was picked up for one more season, the season that we shot the pilot of 227, then 227 would not have gone. So it was kind of bittersweet. Because
there was an opening in the schedule, or because Marla Gibbs was available?
Because Marla Gibbs would be available.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, you know, I was aware of all of the things that she was doing in the community. Marla used to have a kind of like a jazz club in L.A. called Marla's Memory Lane. So that was like a place where a lot of people would meet. Entertainers came to town, they would perform at her club. So Marla was kind of like a pillar in the Black community and as a trailblazer in Hollywood, doing things that a lot of other celebrities, especially female celebrities, weren't doing.
So you think that she gave your mother a sense of security that you'd be in good hands?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because my mom... she was a teacher, and she was not the type of mother that was going to quit her job to be a set mom. She found someone that would be a guardian on the set with me, that was a close friend of the family that she could trust. And then her conversation with Marla, you know, sitting down with Marla and my mom just saying that, look, I don't want Regina to go to one of these small schools that NBC wants her to go to for kids that are on TV. I want Regina to stay in a regular public school because I don't want her to get out of touch. And Marla supported it. And so my mom felt like, okay, this is a good space for her.
So you went to public school. You continued
to learn? I went to public. I graduated from Westchester High. I'm a product of LA Unified.
So once you started to become famous from being on 227, how did that change your stature in school?
It changed it somewhat, but not much. I had been going on auditions and things like that since I was probably 10, 11 years old. So I felt pretty regular, I have to say. I felt pretty normal, and I'm really grateful for that because I still get my own dry cleaning to this day.
Seriously? I know that didn't sound like a big deal, but it actually does. So what's it like to be 10 and feel like you have a calling, that you want to work professionally, that you know what you want to do?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did not know until I decided to drop out of college that this is what I wanted to do as a career. Probably from the age of 10 to 16, I still wanted to be a dentist.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Maybe the end of my first semester of my sophomore year, I realized that college just was not my jam. And that I felt like I was learning more when I was actually on set. And I think a lot of that had to do with I was working while I was in college. I was on 227. So I didn't get a chance to really be immersed in the culture of my school.
In 1991, you were in Boys in the Hood, which was directed by John Singleton, set in South Central L.A. And, you know, it's about young people who are in gangs, who drink a lot, and the kind of intentional and accidental feuds and fighting and problems that happen between them. And what a cast. It was like Ice Cube, Cuba Gooding, Lawrence Fishburne, Angela Bassett, you. You played Shalikas. Describe your character.
She was a girl in the hood who probably did not have as much parental support as maybe a couple of the other kids in that movie. She was like, I think a lot of young people finds that sense of family in the streets. That's who she was. She was the fun girl.
So how did you get the voice that you needed for this, which wasn't your voice, wasn't your character, Brenda's voice? I'm not sure what kind of neighborhood you grew up in, whether people talk this way in your neighborhood?
Not far from my neighborhood, yes. But once again, when I said I'm so grateful for my mom just being adamant about me staying in public school, that is what allowed me to be exposed to so many different types of people. I elected to do busing. And at those schools, you had such a mix of so many types of kids. So there were a lot of girls that I was around that was Shalika.
Well, why don't we hear my guest Regina King in a scene from Boys in the Hood.
Girl, he is fine. I like to rush that. He go to Washington? He go to Crenshaw. Girl, I've seen him before. He work at the Fox Hills Mall. Do he got a girlfriend? Yes. Jamaican girl was scoping on this hoe's man. He fine anyway. You better watch his ass. Somebody might steal.
That's Regina King, my guest in Boys in the Hood. Were you hoping that you would be the leading lady in films, like the romantic lead, or did you really see yourself more as the character actor?
I would probably say a little bit of both. I think more I saw myself as a character actor because it's just more interesting.
Well, one romantic comedy that you were in was Jerry Maguire. And you played Cuba Gooding's wife, his character's wife, and he's a football player whose agent is Jerry Maguire. You're his, like, loving but also forceful wife who's pushing for the best contract for him. And you don't think that Jerry Maguire, his sports agent, is doing the best job for him. So in this scene, you're waiting for Jerry Maguire, played by Tom Cruise, in Jerry Maguire's office. Your young son is with you, and he's playing with all the sports memorabilia in the office and starting to, like, throw it around and make a lot of noise. Finally, Jerry Maguire walks in. Here's the scene.
Jerry, I'm glad to see you finally made it. Rod is very, very upset.
Yeah!
Tyson, no.
Okay, Mommy.
Tyson, hello?
Hello, Jerry. Long time no see.
What did I say, Tyson?
How can I make your life better?
Jerry, this is humiliating, and I'm pregnant, and I'm incapable of bull. Where is our offer from Arizona?
Cronin's okay for lunch?
Marcy's just one of our agents. Bob Sugar needs to learn to knock.
Pleasure.
You've called our house, right?
I'm sorry to interrupt you guys.
Now, I don't know what you do for your 4%, but this man, my husband, has a whole plan, an image. And when you put him in a waterbed warehouse commercial, excuse me, you're making him common. When you know we deserve the big four. Shoe, car, clothing line, soft drink. I know about the four jewels of the celebrity endorsement dollar.
Wow.
I majored in marketing, baby, and so did my husband. We came to play.
You're going to show him. What did you do to get in character for that?
Oh, wow. Well, when I was auditioning for that, I was actually pregnant. So I was definitely in the space of understanding how important the family you create is.
So you had your baby and raised him for many years as a single mother. Did you ever feel like you needed to give your son the talks about being a young black man in America and how to deal with police if you're stopped and, you know, all that stuff?
Absolutely. If you're not having that conversation as a Black parent, you're doing your child a disservice.
What kind of things did you feel like you should tell your son?
One of the things is that, you know, when Ian was coming up, he was going to a school that, you know, where a lot of affluent kids. And just kind of had to let him know that this environment that you're in is not how things are everywhere. For example, like when you're having the conversation with your child about getting their driver's license, well, a white family, their biggest fear is just that they're driving safely and that they're minding the rules of the road. Whereas a Black family, their biggest fear is that their child is going to get pulled over and treated unfairly for a reason that they won't understand. It's my responsibility to try to help him understand that just because it does not make sense to you doesn't mean that it's not possible that it would happen. And most of us have had that happen. And almost every Black man or young Black man has had that happen. At least I can speak for LA.
Well, Regina King, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Regina King speaking with Terry Gross. King stars in the ABC series American Crime and co-stars in the HBO series The Leftovers. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.